do the computer thing here real quick, and I'll ad lib while we do that. Put everything. Hopefully, Lord willing, everything will go tonight. I've taped. I've taped the plug in, so that maybe we'll get less issue. Voila. Okay, there we go. Well, thank you for coming and hearing my wife's testimony this afternoon. She said that she had a wonderful time, a really delightful time with all the gals there this afternoon. And then to have a Saturday evening and come out and listen to a creation speaker is really a blessing for you to be here. Tonight's talk, what you see up on the screen, is a scientific poster. I asked the pastor, remember last night what he said? He said that nobody was anxious to go home, and therefore just tell people what you want to tell them. Well, yesterday I asked him, how creation savvy is your congregation? You know what savvy means? It's like, how really, really, really refined are you guys in creation? And he said, there's nobody better. And so I said, oh, okay, good. That's what I said. Well, would they like a little more of a challenging talk? He said, bring it on. And I said, okay, so we'll do this. Tonight's talk is if you went to a creation science scientific conference where all the attendees are other creation scientists. And they're presenting their research. They're presenting new ideas. They're presenting things. And if you do, I'm going to step down again, you would see that sometimes they put up a scientific poster that kind of outlines the research. Well, tonight's talk is not for you to necessarily go out and repeat this to somebody else. Tonight's talk is to have, there's several objectives tonight. First, instead of tearing down some of this silly evolutionary thinking, let's replace that thinking with some better thinking. Better thinking. You know, creationists, we have a model of how things probably worked, but nobody ever talks about that model. We're going to talk about the model tonight. We're going to look at something as if it was right at the beginning of creation and try to explain it. Second, all of us believe that this body is designed, but hardly any of us think about it and explain it as if it were designed. So tonight, we're going to bring in a way of looking at living things. It's going to be one element on your body, your immune system, and we're going to try to reinterpret the immune system in a better way using design analysis. So just sit back, listen. There'll be some things that are going to be like, what in the world is he talking about? And some of you are going to be catching them. Other stuff is going to be like, wow, this is very, very interesting. I never knew that before. So this is a scientific poster. There's an introduction, and you have questions, you have research methods and stuff like this. And as you can see up there, it says design analysis. Design analysis confers a better understanding of our immune system as a microbe interface system. Now, all of you know what your immune system is. It's used for doing what? Fighting disease. That's what. Boy, have we got a lot to do to re-educate you on that. It does fight disease, but that is not its primary purpose. Primary purpose is to be what it says up there as a microbe interface system. And it's all going to begin with some work by this researcher right here. His name was Joe Francis. He teaches at the Master's Seminary. It's a seminary that the Master's College that John MacArthur started. And he's a microbiologist. And almost 20 years ago, he was saying, no, bacteria, they're not your enemies. Bacteria are probably your friends. And even viruses are probably your friends. And they were created to work together with you. And they perform a life-sustaining function. And he called it the vital organosubstrate of life. In other words, if the bacteria were suddenly gone off of this planet, all life would die very quickly. That's how important they are. And he says that we were got along with him very well. Now, this is a picture of, it's a micrograph of a bacteria. It's kind of cool looking. It looks like a corkscrew, right? It's called Treponema pallidum. And it actually, if you had this in your body, there'd be a good chance that you'd get the disease called syphilis. Now, I'm not saying that Joe Francis had syphilis by any means, but if Joe Francis is right, there was a time that he could live in harmony with all kinds of bacteria, even Treponema, that this was there. So first thing is, let's change our thinking from this warlike worldview, where you're always fighting something, to where you're not fighting, but you're really in harmony. Oh, hey, Joe looks better on that. There's less glare off his head. Anyway, so on that. And we're going to go with this new research method, which is called design analysis. Now, design analysis is the opposite of what most biologists do. Most biologists reverse engineer something. You know what reverse engineering is? Is if you didn't know what this clicker was that advances my slides, you would take it and you would start to take it apart bit by bit by bit and try to figure out how it works by slowly taking something off and seeing if something worked and those kinds of things. That's reverse engineering. Design analysis goes in the exact opposite. It says, if I want to build something to advance slides, what would I need to put into something to do that? So you think through in advance of your objective, just as an engineer would, and you build it. And I'm suggesting that my biologist colleagues do that before they reverse engineer something. Figure out, how would I build it? What would I need to put into it? What are the key elements? And then when you reverse engineer it, it's easier to figure out how it works on that. So here's the key question. How in the world do you get a microbe? It could be a fungus, or it could be a virus, or it could be a bacteria. How do you get one of those to work together with a human being? That's an interesting question, because nobody thinks about it, because they just do. But you don't just do with that. You don't just order, hey, microbe, work with that human. You can't just force them to work together. Like my mom used to say, you know, play with your sister. That's not going to happen. So, you just don't order something to happen. And you don't just stick microbes next to human beings and say, okay, work together. How do you get two independent, autonomous entities? That's what you are. You're an autonomous entity. A microbe is an autonomous entity, believe it or not. It's an independent, autonomous entity. How do you get two of those things to work together?
Same goal,
but I don't know if bacteria have goals on that, you know. You want to live. There you go. Wow. Now, there's a good one. Well, thinking about it as an engineer, look at this. When I was a kid, We had a mortal enemy, the Soviet Union. You remember that? Those were the good old days. I mean, there was so much more stability in the world back then on that. Because we kept our friends in line and they smacked theirs in line in that. But, you know, we didn't want to have a nuclear war, so we tried to have detente. And then this was Apollo aircraft that's going to hook up with this Soyuz. Now, how do you get those two independent things to work together? What did they stick on the nose of that? They stuck an interface. It's a connecting module. And it connects the Soyuz to an Apollo. This connecting module is called an interface. You have to put something like that on independent entities. So you have to have something in your body which is going to interface with bacteria. It has to be there. All right, look at this guy. He's sitting on that John Deere, and now you have a human being trying to connect to a machine. What do you put on that? You put those things, those hand-shaped things that connect him to the machine. They're called handles, but they fit his hands, and they connect to the machine. And guess what these are? These are an interface. It connects him to the machine. Connects him to the machine. How in the world do you connect a human being to a drain pipe? I mean, that's how you have to do this. How do you get a human being connected to a drain pipe? Well, you have to put together an interface. An interface. And that's what that is. So anytime you have two independent autonomous things and you want to get them to work together, you have to connect them with an interface. And already you're seeing some of the key elements of an interface. They have features kind of like a Soyuz and features kind of like an Apollo. They have features kind of like a machine, kind of like a human. They have a feature kind of like a pipe and kind of like an end. I don't know what you'd call that, the rear end or something like that, but it fits. It fits both entities, and it's able to bridge them together. See, already you're beginning to say, oh, I'll never look at these things the same way again on all of that. So, can creationists, if we completely eliminate evolutionary thinking, as if Charles Darwin had never been born, could we come up with our own explanations on that? Can we derive a better observation of this enigma of a pre-fall immune system? And the reason why I say it's an enigma is because people have come up to me and say, you know, did Adam have an immune system before the fall? I mean, if there was no death and suffering, why would he have to have an immune system? Well, that's a good question. It's a good question if you think of it only in terms of defense. But if you think of it in terms of an interface that he has to work with microbes before the fall, well, maybe there was another function. Maybe it's a continuing function for this immune system that wasn't there to protect him. It was there to connect him to those bacteria. So if you look at this gal here. She wants to connect to her computer. What's on the screen of the computer? A graphical user interface, a GUI, where you can click on little icons and they connect you to the operating system of that. But then if this computer wants to connect to another computer, any type of computer, guess what they're going to program? An interface that connects them together. And if you want to connect to a company like Amazon, any of you ever bought anything on Amazon? Of course you have. It's connecting not just you to the company, but at any one moment, hundreds of thousands of people are connected to that company. And they're all being connected by an interface. An interface. So, what are some of the essential elements of an interface? Well, you have a human machine and they're going to interface. So if you look on the human side over here, there's sensors. He's got eyes and ears. He has actuators, a way to affect things. And cognition connects these, connects his senses to his actuators so that he can make decisions. Well, look what you have on the machine side. You have actuators, you have sensors, and you have a processor. You have essentially the same things between the machines and the humans in order to connect those together. And so possibly humans are connected to microbes by the same kinds of functions, but instead of doing hundreds of thousands of interactions at any moment, you're literally doing trillions of interactions at any moment. Trillions. That's how many bacteria you have on your skin, in your lungs. And for most of this talk, I'm going to be looking at one place, your gut. Your gut. Just plumb chuck full of bacteria and other kinds of microbes. So what do you have to have a good interface? Well, these researchers came up with three indispensable elements of an interface. First is authentication. The pink tells you what that element is. The blue is where you find it in our so-called immune system here. But authentication, just if you're taking notes, they're basically mechanisms for differentiating self from non-self. So if you're going to connect two independent entities and to get them to work together, you have to know what is you and what is me. A way to differentiate what? Self from non-self. Now, these mechanisms also allow you to validate or authorize non-selves. So I may not want to connect with you. So you're invalid, because I might have rules to say who's authorized to connect with me and who is not authorized to connect with me. Does that make sense? And on top of that, I might want to limit my exposure. How much of me do I want you to know? And vice versa. How much of you do I want to know? So you have ways to limit your exposures, and those are called disclosures. So authentication, this is actually kind of simple, but you kind of get the idea. It's self from non-self. How much am I going to expose? How much am I going to disclose to the non-self entity? Now the heart, the real heart of any kind of interface, are the protocols. And they're just rules governing who, what, why, when, and how exchanges are going to take place. If I want to exchange something with you, particularly code, there has to be a rule of how these exchanges are going to take place. And those are protocols. And really, self versus non-self is just it's another type of protocol. But it's so important it's given its own category. And protocols, they specify how these exchanges are going to take place. There's rules. You don't just put a product out and get it. There's rules for how these exchanges will take place. And which of these entities know the rules? One entity or both entities? Both entities know the rules. And they have to have the rules. And most of the time, interfaces allow the exchanges of two things. They usually allow the exchanges of information, or they allow the exchanges of products. Information and products. Right now, I'm connected to you by an interface. What is the interface? Sound. I have something in my voice that compresses sound. It compresses air. Compresses air into little packets. And these little compressed air pockets go across the room, and you have something that picks them up. That's called your ears, but since you guys are really savvy, what's really in your ears that's picking them up? Your ear drums. They pick them up and it translates that. There's a code. And then in terms of the protocol, since we have a little extra time, this is really what's fascinating. Immaterially, a thought originates in my mind. It gets put together in a mysterious way, I don't know yet, and I don't think anybody does, in my nervous system, into ways to control my vocal cords. I compress and then I convert that to words, a code. My words are a code. They get compressed, they hit your eardrums, and then they get reconverted to electrochemical signals to go back to your brain, and then your brain decodes it, and it pops into your brain as a thought as well. Now that's how these interfaces work. And if you didn't know the code, i.e. you didn't speak English, then I could not communicate with you. But we have a common code, the English language, on that. If I was down in Texas, I struggle to communicate with them because they have a different code, you know, down there. They have a different everything down there. Pastor's going to say, get off the Texans, but all right, on that. But they have a different code. So those are what protocols are. And then finally, there has to be a common medium. This is the easiest one to understand. There has to be something which both entities can attach to or plug into, some physical medium. The medium connecting me to you is this air. I'm using air as a common medium. But there has to be something that both entities can pick up on. That's what those are. They're usually conditions, and in terms of living things, they're biochemical conditions. You have biochemical conditions, bacteria use biochemical conditions, both of them can plug into those, and that's usually the medium at which all of these things are happening in your chemical processes inside your body. So you have those three things. Those are the main ones. You have authentication, protocols, and a common medium. See, scientific conferences really aren't that hard, are they? You just go through your poster And usually at scientific conferences, nobody wants to really listen to somebody blather about their poster. So they do what? They bribe them with candy or something like that. And they have a big bowl of candy. So someone comes up and they grab a handful and they feel a little guilty. So they'll listen to you talk about your poster for a few minutes and then walk off thinking, what in the world? Anyway, so that's what we're doing. I'm blathering here about my poster. Yeah. All right. Let's go to authentication, and I'll give you a couple of examples of how organisms authenticate, and that these are kind of cool. All right, this one right here, this is a paper published in 2005, and this person says, self versus non-self discrimination is a central theme in biology from plants to vertebrates and is particularly relevant for lymphocytes. Lymphocytes are white blood cells. Yeah. White blood cells, those are lymphocytes. On that, for lymphocytes that express receptors capable of recognizing self tissue from foreign invaders. Now you notice this person is looking at bacteria in a warlike fashion, right? They're foreign invaders. Foreign invaders. Let's think a little bit different than they're not foreign invaders, but the first part of the statement is true. Self versus non-self discrimination is important. It's a central theme. How many organisms do it? All organisms do it. Not some. All organisms do it. Do plants do it? Yes. All of them do it. They have to know self from non-self. Well, this is how lymphocytes, they get licensed. Do they come out? They don't necessarily know self from non-self. Initially, in fact, they're not going to attack anything. They have to go through a process here, and I wrote down the process, but eventually once they go through this process, you get certain lymphocytes which are licensed to kill. They're like the 007 little Bond, you know, and then you have some which are unlicensed and they won't go out killing. But once they get licensed to kill, and that's the process, they can recognize self from non-self, and they will go out. NK, NK, that stands for it's called a natural killer cell, a natural killer cell. It's really part of the mob, and its job is to just kill, and it does it naturally. That's why it's called a natural killer. Well, that's one way of doing this. Well, it's not just true for human beings and plants. Actually, bacteria themselves are able to determine self from non-self, even from a virus. And here's the quote from this paper, all immune systems must distinguish self from non-self, blah, 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 blah. It goes on to say, this method is a broadly applicable solution to the self-non-self dilemma that confronts all immune pathways. So even bacteria, as supposedly simple as they are, they actually have ways to distinguish self from non-self. So everything does it. Now let's go to the protocols. Protocols are rules governing exchanges and behaviors. Now there's two ways that I could govern you, for instance. One way is I could come up to this guy right here, say, wake up, I will govern you. And I could actually grab him physically grab him. I'm not going to, but I could on that. I could physically take hold of him and control him physically. That's one way of doing it. And your body has ways of doing actual physical controls. Direct physical contact. And here's really a cool way. When you have certain bacteria in your body and your body wants to destroy them, there's a pathway called the complement pathway, which has tiny little proteins in your bloodstream, which will organize themselves into a circular ring, which will actually punch a hole through the cell wall of a bacteria. And this is an electron micrograph of what it looks like on the outside of a cell wall. All of these little dots are little holes that are punched into it. And if you look at one from the side, here's that little ring punching a hole. And when it punches a hole in the cell wall of bacteria, all of those guts of the cytoplasm squish out and the bacteria dies. Direct physical contact builds it together, and actually attacks it and controls it. Now, that's kind of cool, but you want to know what's even more interesting, in my opinion, is the way to get control over a non-self entity without actually having to touch it. And this is the most interesting part. How do you do that with an interface? Well, the interface designer, the person who puts an interface together, he has to know everything about the non-self entity. And he has to know everything about me. He thoroughly knows this entity, and he thoroughly knows this entity, so that he knows if I present a product to you, this product to you, he will respond in a certain way. And I never touch you. They know if I do this, he will do this. Does that make sense? So I never touch him. I just present, here's the key word, certain conditions to you. And when you detect those conditions, you will respond in a certain way. And then he will present conditions, and when I detect those conditions, I will respond in a certain way. That is really cool. I don't touch him. I don't say anything. I just, here's a condition, and he does it, and vice versa. Well, that's exactly how humans react with a lot of these microbes. And instead of looking them at in a warlike fashion, we should look at a host or a microbe, we're the host, as a requester and the other as a provider. At one time, when you're working with Amazon, you're a requester. You want this product. And Amazon is the what? Provider. Requester, provider. But at any one time in your body, you may be the requester and the bacteria is the provider. It's giving you a product. But the roles can reverse. The bacteria can be a requester and your body can be a provider. It goes back and forth, back and forth. Requester, provider, and they do this by an interface which has protocols governing how they're going to relate to each other. So at one moment you're a requester and Amazon's the provider, but pretty soon Amazon's going to send you a message that says, give me your what? Credit card number, and they're the requester, and you'll be the provider. And this is how it really works. And this is probably how it was. I shouldn't even say probably, because it is happening right this moment in your body, of how Adam was relating to his microbes in his body. And engineers call this a condition, consequence, process, or protocol. I present you a condition, you will respond in a certain way. I present you a condition, you respond in a certain way. You present me a condition, I respond. And it goes back and forth, in a mutually beneficial way. And this is what's happening right now. Billions of times in your body. Your body is doing this right now. Well, let's look at a kind of an interesting example of requester providers. This is research by this gal. I'm just going to call her McFall. And she does research on a tiny little squid. Now, this is what it looks like. The squid can glow. It can glow in the dark. It's greatly magnified because the squid is only 2 millimeters long. Tiny, tiny, tiny little squid. It's called a bobtail squid. Let's explain how this works. We're going to go through A through H on this. All right, mama squid gives birth to little baby squids out in the ocean. And there's trillions of bacteria and everything around them. But it wants a particular type of bacteria to move inside its body, and the bacteria is called Vibrio. It can actually cause diseases now, this type of bacteria. But with the squid, it doesn't. It doesn't cause it. I'm just going to call it the squid and the bacteria. What's interesting is it says right up here, right after it's born, this little squid in an ocean can detect as few as 5 of those little bacteria in the water. It detects the bacteria in the water. Once it does that, it activates a gene within itself for an antimicrobial, and all the other bacteria around it are not able to handle that antimicrobial, and they die, except the Vibrio live. And then the Vibrio, they detect a certain chemical that's released within a light organ. This is a light organ within the squid, and these Vibrio will migrate into this light organ within the squid. But then as soon as the squid detects the bacteria are in the light organ, they seal off the light organ, enclosing the squid within them for the rest of their life, bringing them within the squid. Then the squid, these little bacteria migrate in. Once the squid closes them off, it'll make a chemical called a cryptochrome. It produces a chemical called a cryptochrome. Once the bacteria detect the cryptochrome, they start to glow. They glow in the dark. They detect that, and the bacteria then will start to glow. The squid detects the glowing of the bacteria, and it makes more cryptochrome. And then the bacteria, when they detect increases of cryptochrome, they glow even more. And it produces this, so it glows just at night. And why are these squid glowing? To attract a mate, of course. That's the only reason you do anything. I mean, that's it on there. So they glow. So it goes back and forth and back and forth. And they're presenting conditions. And when they detect it, they respond back. Isn't that kind of cool? Now, the little gray box down here, and it's just a little fun fact. It says the squid, it can detect out of the millions of bacteria inside of it, any of those bacteria that aren't glowing, and it kicks them out. Boom. It ejects them out of its body. It only wants true glowers in there, and it can put them out. Now that is an interesting way. This is called condition consequence. Now if you're an evolutionist, your worldview is very different. You think the environment is running the show. It's always going to be the environment controlling. It's always going to be something external to you, forcing you to do something. So this whole thing that I just discussed here, this is how it's written up inside the paper. And it's wrong, but this is how it's written in scientific paper after paper after paper. When the Vibrio, that's the bacteria, first touches the squid, it changes the expression of scores of squid genes. A finding made, blah, 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 blah. Totally wrong. It doesn't change anything in the squid. It's there, the squid detects it, and the squid changes its own genes. Very, very important. This is very important because it's showing that the causality is really in the squid and the causality is not in the bacteria. It's inside of you. It's inside of you. And in fact, this researcher, Cabej, said in 2013, I wish I could drum this into all my biology friends. In everyday parlance, environmental stimuli are said to induce or even regulate the expression of specific genes. This notion is so engraved in the biological conceptual system that it comes as a revelation when upon closer scrutiny it turns out that no external stimuli can directly induce the expression of any gene are known. Nothing. What's that saying is nothing goes directly from the environment into you and changes you. It doesn't happen. But that's the way evolutionists think. This is molding you. This is changing you. This is making you. No, this is what happens. It's out there. It may be transported into your body. Your body will bring it in. Then your body will process it. And then your body will adjust itself. That's how it'll work. But for some reason, most of my biology friends go from condition to response, and they forget all of the engineered steps in between. This caused that. This caused that. But it doesn't really do that. So, I hope this will play.
It is through 50 years of daring that we have been able to offer drivers peace of mind. 50 years of designing cars for crash survival that led us to our most revolutionary feature yet. A car that can see trouble and stop itself to avoid it.
That's how biological systems really work. That's how you need to see things. This is how it really happens. That car slung up the track and it stopped. What did the commercial say? It stopped itself. It stopped itself. Did this wall stop the car? No. How did it stop itself? Automatically. What do you think's on the tip of this car somewhere? Some kind of sensor of some sort. Maybe it's a camera. Maybe it's ultrasound. Maybe it's infrared. It could be a laser. It's got to be something. It has to be there. There's something up here that detects the wall, and then it sends a signal into the car. I bet you there's a computer in here in the car that says, if this, then do this. In other words, if there's a wall, then what? Stop. Apply the brakes. That's really how it works. This is how living things really work. But I guarantee you it'll be written up in scientific literature like, the wall stopped the car. And that's how it'll be presented. And all of this other stuff, which actually is stopping itself, is almost always overlooked. And in many times, biologists don't even look for it. They don't even look for it. They see a wall, they see a car stop, ergo, it stopped it. But if anybody had the real job of really building this car, like that, did you see that smug engineer at the end? It's like, yeah. Well, I'd be kind of smug too. Because this is a pretty cool engineering accomplishment. That's a cool engineering accomplishment, but God did far cooler engineering accomplishments in all kinds of living things. And living things work like this. That's how they really work. And this is how you're working together with the microbes inside of you. So, this is, I'm basically going to say that we have these rules to express it. Now let's look at this kind of complicated but really simple picture. It looks complicated because what? There's lots of little drawings on. There's lots of parts, but it's really not. Let's take it between blue and yellow here. This is organism A, we'll call what? Self, and this will be organism B, non-self. They have a way of detecting self and non-self, and they work together. Now let's look on the outside of organism A. I have all these little pictures here. I have a triangle and a little pentagram, all these little things and stars. There, I guarantee you, on the outside of organism A, there'll be a detector. There'll be a triangle detector. There'll be a pentagon detector. We'll call those inputs. When organism A detects this thing, it will go to a logic center within the organism that says, if 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, then do these things. One of the things it can do is it can put more product out to itself so that it stimulates itself. Organisms can stimulate themselves. It could put another product out which could be toxic to organism B. It could put another product out that could be a stimulus for organism B. It could put a product out that could be a product for itself within itself. It could put a signal out to cause itself to self-destruct, or it could put a signal out to control its own logic center. Isn't that kind of cool? Organisms could do any one of those things. If this condition, then do 1, 2, 3, 4, or X, Y, or Z. It can do any of those things. Now, when it puts out something that is toxic to another organism, toxicity, this is another thing, is always determined by your own traits. It is not determined by the substance. It's like it's always thought of, it's the substance. But that's not true. In the living world, I can give a substance to you and it's toxic to you, but I can give it to another creature and it's nourishment to that creature. It's not the substance, it's always the traits of the organism itself. You're going to see I'm going back to the self, back to the organism, back to the entity, which are always determining toxicity. It's always determining what can be harmful to you is always your traits. Always your traits. So, if I drive up in a tank, and a telephone pole falls on my tank, what does it do? It just what? Bounces off. It just bang, bounces off. If the pastor drove up in his Volkswagen, and the telephone pole falls on his Volkswagen, what does it do? Smashes it. Looking for a new pastor. Sorry, pastor. Okay. Well, who don't you like in the church? Anyway, so we'll make them drive up on the Volkswagen on that. It's the traits of the entity that determine it. If I go up, smack a fly, what did I just do to the fly? Killed it. But I smack him with the same force. Kill him? No. Make him mad, but it doesn't kill him. You see, it's the trait. I go up to an elephant. Smack. You know? That's exactly right. My hand is what's hurt. It's the traits. It's the traits of the thing. And that doesn't necessarily mean bad design. It doesn't mean bad design. God did not design us to be invulnerable. Why? I don't know. We'll have to ask him. But he did not make us invulnerable. But certain where we can withstand certain exposures and we cannot. The mere fact that we are not made invulnerable is not a bad design, because as an engineer, I never built something that would be invulnerable. I only had so much money, so much resources, and I had to build it so that it operated within what? Parameters. Certain parameters. That's not bad design if it's exposed to something outside of its parameters and it breaks. People, see, this is the thing. People automatically think because you broke, bad design. That isn't bad design. It's just something exceeded my parameters. And it doesn't necessarily mean bad design. In addition to that, I can build something as an engineer that I want to fail on purpose. So in this car, where we had the car up there, not only will I have a sensor in the front of the car, I guarantee you there'll be part of the front of the car which is built in such a way that if it were to actually hit the wall, it would crumple up, crumple, crumple, crumple up, shove the engine down into the ground instead of back into you. And it's made to do what? Brake on purpose so that it absorbs the energy so that it doesn't hurt you. Well, what if I go up to a gecko and I grab a gecko by its tail? What happens? The tail comes off. Something else that's kind of made to break. It's not bad design. It's really good designs. So when your evolutionist friends comes up to you and they say, well, you look at that, you did this, bad design. No, 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 no. Just like everything else, operating within parameters. Okay, that's why that's an expression of toxicity. And then finally, this is really important. We have a specified stimulus and a specified detector. This is also really important. Right now, you are being exposed to literally hundreds of different types of conditions. And some of those conditions you respond to, but you don't respond to every condition. That's because whoever designed you and specified within you, this will be a stimulus. Catching this, it goes back to the creature again. It goes back to the creature. Inside the creature, someone said, this will be a stimulus, this will be a stimulus, and this will be a stimulus, but these will not be a stimulus. What is a stimulus is always based on what is specified within you. And whoever specifies something to be a stimulus will equip you with a detector so that you can detect what they want to be a stimulus. Does that make sense? So we call these things photoreceptors in our eyes, but in reality, they're photodetectors. Photodetectors. They're detecting photons. And when they detect those photons, they send a signal. That's how it really works in engineering lingo. This is how it really is in biology, even though biologists kind of get it backwards. They call these receptors as if this thing is passive and this thing is outside of it, is active. This is what's really active, and it's actively surveilling and detecting for things. On top of that, so how many of you right now are being bombarded with AM radio waves? All of us are. How many of you are listening to AM radio in your head? Are you really, ma'am? No, you're not. You did that. You did it so seriously. I thought, wow, I need to refer you to my friend over here. He'll give you some medications for that. But if you're really listening to that in your head, what are the voices telling you? Anyway, so I may not want to know on that. You're a good sport. All right. Well, why aren't you listening to AM radio in your head? You don't have a detector. Therefore, it's not really a stimulus to you. All right. Then if you detect this, it puts out a particular response. Let's look at some of these. Let's look at an icon of evolution, blind cave fish. Now, we're generally told, you know, you have these fish with eyes. They find themselves somehow stranded inside a dark cave. And you have to have at least a male and a female. And eyes inside a cave are kind of a detriment. They run into stuff. They get scratched. They get banged up. And pretty soon, over many, many, many years, the fish loses its pigment, becomes kind of albino, and it loses its eyes. In other words, it's a classic example of what they would call natural selection. Now, you heard me slap it around last night, that nature can't select anything on that. That's a classic story. Over many generations, these eyes, instead of being a value, they become a detriment, and they go blind. Now, let's study this for a second. This fish loses its eyes. The fish also loses its pigment. And then what's also interesting, you notice the skull is a little bit different in this. The area that was occupied in the skull for these orbits is changed. The brain is changed, and certain areas of the brain which are sensitive to tactile stimuli and auditory stimuli and olfactory stimuli increase. So now this fish is better at detecting these other things that are stimuli. And not only does it happen in fish, crayfish, crickets, anything that finds himself into these caves basically does almost the same thing. That doesn't sound like an accident to me. That sounds like a programmed mechanism. That's when organisms are commanded to be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth, that included caves. And when these creatures find themselves into caves, eyes diminish, other things increase. That sounds like a good design to me. And I wrote that up in a paper. I wrote that up in 2011 in a paper and said, maybe this isn't an accident. Maybe this is a designed process. And then this paper came out in 2013, Rapid Evolution, ha. Anyway, rapid is right, rapid. And then look at this, environmental change triggers. You see, everything is written up as if the environment is doing it. Well, what's really happening is this. These fish can go from sighted to blind in one generation because a particular protein called Heekshot protein 90 is adjusted during embryonic development of these fish. And mama fish can detect the darkness, it actually detects the cave environment, and in one generation, you can go from sighted fish to blind fish. And depending on the cave conditions, you can get variations in eyes along this entire gradient. Bang. It detects the cave condition, and it sends a signal to developing embryo. This protein is adjusted during embryonic development, and a whole slew of things are changed during development to give you this change.
Can it go in reverse too?
No.
Okay.
I don't know. No, I don't know.
I know that's
what I'm saying. No, I don't know.
Oh, okay.
No, I don't know because nobody's done the experiment yet. No, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. That's kind of cool if it would be reversible. But nobody's run it in reverse yet. Now, the only thing I got wrong in my write-up is I detected that mama fish was detecting light. But this is what's cool. The fish aren't detecting light. They're detecting water conductivity.
Curious.
Yeah, curious. The water in a stream has different conductivities than the water in the cave. They detect this conductivity and they adjust this protein. They're not necessarily detecting light. Yeah, it's kind of cool. But nevertheless, it happens in one generation. Here's another illustration. Mice can warn sons and grandsons of danger via sperm. Well, that's kind of a truncated scenario of what's happening here on that. Okay, this is the experiment. You take a bunch of male mice, and you expose them to cherry blossom odor. But they're standing on a metal pad. And the moment they're exposed to cherry blossom odor, you put electrical charge on the pad, and it shocks their feet. It doesn't electrocute them, but it hurts. And you expose them to an odor, you shock their feet. Expose them to an odor, shock, expose, shock. Biologists love doing this kind of stuff. I mean, it's just like, and they're zapping the mice. Okay, then you take these male mice and you breed them with naive females. Not the kind of naive females that humans are looking for, but naive females. These are female mice that have never been exposed to cherry blossom odors ever. Ever. And then she has pups. And then you take the pups, and as soon as they're born, you sacrifice them. You kill them, and then you dissect them through their olfactory region, and you stain it. And you look to see what's happened. And this is what they found. This is the olfactory bulbs of caged mice with no odor exposure. Here's an olfactory, we call them receptors, it's really a detector, and here's the nerves. Here's offspring, this is another control, neutral odors and no foot shocks. Here's the offspring of the male mice that were exposed to the cherry blossom odors and foot shocks. Look at all these receptors and look at all the nerves. Huge increase. How in the world did that happen? That's like I wasn't taught that it's supposed to happen like that. Well, how it happens is dad detects these odors, detects something, and puts different markers on the sperm, on the genome in the sperm. It doesn't change the DNA, but there are markers on the sperm, on the DNA, which are passed on to offspring, which during development change the regulation of those genes controlling these receptors and the nerves, saying, run, 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 and make more. And it's not just any olfactory receptor. These receptors are specific for what odor?
Cherry blossom odor.
in these offspring. Now that's kind of fascinating. That's really fascinating on how that happens. And it's passed along on markers, which are transmitted, as it said on the headline, via sperm. All right. Then look at all these finches. This is another evolutionary thing. You get all these different beaks of all these different finches. Now the typical story is mama bird produces baby birds with all different types of beaks. Some of them can eat certain seeds and some of them can't. Therefore, some of them are favored by the environment and some of them are disfavored by the environment, i.e. some live and some die. And the ones who live, they reproduce with big beaks, and that's how you change the proportion of beaks in a population. That's a typical story. Well, that's not the whole story. What actually happens is during embryonic development, two different proteins are expressed at different amounts at different stages. One's called calmodulin, and one's called bone morphogenic protein 4. And depending on how much is expressed at different stages in development of these birds, you get these different types of beaks. And not only does the beak adjust, but the skull adjusts in development to match the beak at the same time. Does that sound like a design process? Yes. It sure sounds like a design process. And it may be that mom is able to detect her eating conditions and signals are passed on to these little embryos as they develop in an egg, possibly giving these different beaks. I don't know because experiments haven't been done on this. I do know that this paper was published in 2013. Shared developmental program strongly constrains beak shape diversity in songbirds. And this is what was basically found. All of those beak shapes can be reduced to this equation over here. Now, I know that's like a fancy schmancy equation, but everybody recognizes it's a mathematical equation, right? It's a mathematical equation. And this is condition consequence because depending on how these variables, everybody recognizes these are variables, right? How these variables are changed, you get a different outcome. Therefore, you don't have to pack mama bird with all the information for all these different types of beaks. You just have to put within mama bird this function so that when these variables are changed, you get a different beak shape.
In one generation.
Now that's really kind of cool. And not only that, it shows that basically, as you see here in this little picture, you can get all of these different types of beak shapes, but look what it says here. It constrains beak shape diversity. You can get a huge variety of beak shapes, but you will have definite limits to the beak shapes. Definite limits. They will not go on indefinitely. But in between those limits, almost any type of beak shape you want in between them. Wow. Now that's really kind of cool here. So that it leads us to asking the question, how in the world does this interface between you and the microbes, how does it help you to fill the earth? Well, here's an experiment of a paper published in 2014 of how the microbe interface system enables wood rats to rapidly fill niches. And I'll just read the little blip here. Here we demonstrate that gut microbes are crucial in allowing herbivores, that's the wood rat, it eats plants, to consume toxic plants. These results demonstrate that microbes can enhance the ability of hosts to consume plant secondary compounds and therefore expand their dietary niche breadth of mammalian herbivores. Translated, it's this. Wood rats cannot normally eat creosote plants because it's toxic. But instead of changing the DNA in the wood rat, what if I change the composition of the microbes in their gut? I take and I put in different microbes in their gut, and suddenly it eats creosote, and guess what the microbes do inside their gut? They detoxify the creosote and makes it nourishment. So now this wood rat, instead of having to change the DNA in the wood rat, you change their microbes, and now the wood rat can what? Fill another niche. That's kind of cool. So maybe there's many, many, many ways that God has enabled creatures to be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. And I don't even have to change the creature. I can just change the bacteria in and on the creature. Now that's kind of cool to do it like that. And it happens in humans. This is a paper published. Changes in diet can alter gut bacteria in 24 hours. That means a couple weeks ago I was in New York and I'm eating whatever they eat in New York, quahogs or something like that. You know, I'm eating New Yorkian food. And, you know, I'm there for 5 days and pretty soon the gut, the bacteria in my gut are enabling me to eat New York food. And then I immediately got on a plane and I flew out to California. And I'm eating California food. What do they eat? Sprouts or something like that, you know. I'm eating that kind of stuff, you know. And pretty soon the microbes are changing in my gut to enable me to eat their food on that. And then I'm out to Wyoming, and what do you guys eat?
Steak.
I know it. It's what's for dinner, of course. That's it, right here on them. So they can change. But not only does it change here, mother's littlest helpers. Breast milk nourishes the microbes colonizing the neonatal tract. This is a paper just published, I think, last year. Yeah, 2015 on that. Trillions of beneficial microbes within our intestinal tract convert dietary nutrients, blah, 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 blah. And what's basically happening is this. Mom is in a specific environment. She gives birth to a baby who's in her same environment. She has got microbes in her gut which are enabling her to live in that environment. And there are many ways, or at least five different ways that I read about on how those microbes get through. They change the composition of her breast milk. Baby eats it, changing the composition of his gut microbes, enabling him to fit that environment. And here's an interesting one. The most fascinating one is certain cells in her gut can take these gut microbes and encapsulate them whole without destroying them. They travel through her bloodstream, get into her breast milk, and are expressed in the breast milk. Baby drinks them, and then decapsulates the microbes in its gut.
Wow.
Cool. Really cool. I mean, super cool on that. How many of you want to say praise the Lord? I mean, we have a great creator who's made some really cool things. Now, that scientific paper wasn't so bad, was it? You can just go through it bit by bit, by bit, by bit. It gives you to the last point, some conclusions here. What are some implications for our model? First, from a design perspective, this immune system could be more accurately rebranded as an interface. Does everybody see now you need something that enables you to relate to microbes? You need it. It has to be there on that. You have to have an interface. Pre-fall defensive systems are hard to explain in death and survival paradigms, but when you see them as an interface, then it makes perfect sense. And we should have been looking for it all along. We should have been looking for some kind of interface here. Humans have associated with microbes since the beginning of the creation. Therefore, this interface is a design certainty. And then this is important. The microbe interface system has likely not, I should have put that in big capitals, not changed much from its original and continuing purpose of regulation. Regulation. It's regulating the microbes. Sometimes it's regulating them by destroying them. Sometimes it's regulating them by presenting different conditions. But what it's primarily doing is regulating the numbers and the types, the numbers and the types of bacteria in your gut there. So from the very beginning of the creation, it was able to destroy cells. It was always able to destroy cells, those microbes, but microbes are not alive like us. But it wasn't destroying them to keep you free from sickness. It's destroying them to regulate the numbers and types in your body so that when I go to New York, I regulate this. I go to California. I go to Thailand. Or whatever enables them. Design analysis spots these condition consequence mechanisms. that enable creatures, as it says here, to drive themselves through space and time. Evolutionist has the view that environmental challenges are driving organisms passively through space and time. Wrong. Organisms are actively driving themselves through space and time, taking on different conditions. Oh man, this is a long one, but you have to read it to believe it. Design analysis identifies multiple definitely bounded individual kinds of creatures, showing here no loss of identity, though it's almost always misinterpreted in the scientific literature due to the astonishingly close cooperation of these two organisms. And I took these right out of the scientific literature, where they now say that humans and microbes are amalgamated into a human microbe mosaic superorganism or some kind of transhuman collective. Rubbish. And it's kind of rubbish, but I'll translate all that for you. If engineers do their job right, they make an interface that enables the two entities to work very, very, very closely together. In engineering terms, we would say it's a seamless operation. Though we know as engineers, there's still a seam there. But we say it's like it's what? Seamless. But there is still a seam there. It's the same thing with you and microbes. God, the interface designer, made your interface so well, and your microbes and you work so closely and so intimately together, it looks like it's seamless, but there really is a seam there. But the scientists misinterpret that seam, and they say, we're now a human microbe mosaic superorganism, or we're a transhuman collective. Wrong. Microbes are microbes, humans are humans, each reproduces after their own kind. You're just working really, really well together, but you haven't become one. Does that make sense? You're really, really close, but you haven't become one yet. And finally, this microbe interface system allows creatures to rapidly fit and fill new niches without having to change any of their DNA. Wow. Do you have a different appreciation of your interface system now? On that. And so right now, if, let's say, I were to cough on you with some bad germs, I'm not. You're more likely to cough on me. But anyway, on that, your body may start to destroy those, and it looks like it's defensive, but it's still just regulation. You know how I know this? Because your body makes no distinction. It uses the exact same mechanisms to regulate, including destruction, so-called good bacteria and so-called bad bacteria. It doesn't say, here's a bad one, I'm going to employ these mechanisms. Here's a good one, I'm going to employ these mechanisms. Same mechanisms across the board. It's regulating good and bad alike right now. And the only reason why there are bad ones is because of the fall. I could do a whole lecture on that, how some of them are now out of the wrong places and some of them are out in the wrong numbers and et cetera, why they're so-called bad. So there we are. That's it. You have a new appreciation for a system which had to be in your body, enabling two independent entities to work together, and they're brought together by an interface. That's your immune system, so-called immune system. Thank you so much, Pastor. Mm-hmm.